Okay, so last class you saw the Bell inequality or the CHS inequality and the quantum mechanical prediction which violates it. So I made a comment at the end of class which I want to make sure you understood, which is that the apparent non-locality we see through this is not the kind that can be exploited to enable superluminal signaling, and that would be a true conflict with special relativity. I think we can think about special relativity as applying to signals, and this does not allow superluminal or non-local signals. So the conflict is only with the spirit of special relativity, not with the theory itself. The first kind of decisive experimental confirmation was performed by Alain Aspect and collaborators in the early 80s. There have been many experimental confirmations since then. The main idea nowadays is to try to close all of the loopholes simultaneously. So there's a variety of loopholes that have been proposed in terms of why we don't need to believe that Bell's theorem is violated. It's a bit of a bizarre game. I mean, quantum mechanics has been confirmed experimentally in an extremely broad variety of ways with a high precision. And the fact that on philosophical grounds you would expect quantum mechanical predictions to break down in this particular situation is already a bit bizarre, since they're philosophical grounds. And secondly, after experimental confirmation, repeated experimental confirmation, that people would still want to deny those experiments by finding kind of nitpicky loopholes in the experiments is also, in my view, bizarre. But it's a theme of research. And the kind of loopholes we have in mind are the following. I prepare my entangled pair. Usually it's done with photons. I let them propagate far away from each other, and then I measure them. Now, photon detectors are notorious for being not efficient. So they will sometimes not see a photon entering the detector. So what that means is you do the experiment 100 times, you might only see 60 of the events, and the other 40 don't get detected by one or the other detector, and so you throw away that piece of data. And so the general argument is that, well, look, it turns out there can be a conspiracy model where there's some kind of funny post-selection. There's a correlation between whether the event is detected by the detector and whether or not it was going to provide, whether or not it was going to add to the statistics which brought the quantum violation down. So in other words, it could be that the events that you missed are specifically the events that would have made your statistics obey the inequality for S. It would have been less than or equal to 2. So that requires there's some correlation between what outcome you were going to get and whether the detector failed, even though the detectors are tested for all possible polarizations in advance and show no such bias. So it's a very conspiratorial argument. Contrast this with high-energy physics experiments, which, you know, make it into Nature as soon as they're published, and there you throw away probably, of every billion events, you probably keep 10 of them. Right? So you throw away almost all the data. This is one of the reasons why I quit high-energy experimental physics, by the way. It's because you're really cherry-picking the data you like in those experiments. And you guys should take a look sometime at the particle data book, the Physical Review D publishes at the end of the year graphs of measurements of fundamental input parameters to the standard model as a function of time. And you get, I didn't tell these guys this story yet. This blows my mind. So let me just write this out. So for example, the detection efficiency loophole . So here the detector efficiency is of the order 60, 70, 80%, and they need it above some threshold. I can't remember exactly what it is, maybe 90%, so that you can rule out this conspiratorial argument. And that's been done. People have developed detectors that are efficient enough that they can rule out the detection efficiency loophole. There are other loopholes. There's like 2 or 3 of them, and no experiment has been done which simultaneously closes all the loopholes. But that's apparently in the works. It's going to happen probably in the next year or two by, I think, some former students of Zeilinger or something. Yeah.
Does anyone, people have these models you're saying in which they sort of circumstantially explain what might have given Bell's result, what might have given the violation, but do they actually have models that reproduce general quantum mechanical results but don't violate Bell's theorem?
I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think that exists. I've never heard of anything like that. But yeah, I mean, that would be a little more compelling if they could do that. So contrast this with that are essentially order one. For these experiments, with high energy physics experiments, which are order one part in whatever 10^8, say. And then here's why you should be troubled by this. Particle data book, published by Physical Review D, shows historical measurements consider particle data book historical measurements of input parameters, input constants to the standard model. Just consider some parameter alpha, and this is what the data looks like. I don't mean to dislodge your faith in science here, but this is how it works. 1950s, 1990s. You get an initial measurement by some group, like this. A couple years later, you get another measurement, like this. A couple years later, you get another measurement, like this. Again, another one, another one. These are the error bars. And a couple years later, we get another measurement like that, another measurement up here. And one here, here, and you guys all know what error bars are supposed to mean, right? And then it goes up here and it asymptotes with really small error bars. So the asymptotic result is many, many standard, two or three, actually I didn't even draw it as exaggerated as it is. You get two or three standard deviations consistently off, okay? So this tells you a great deal about the sociological factors that go into experiments performed by 200 people. It cost $2 billion.
It's an obvious explanation.
Yeah.
Alpha is increasing. Alpha is time dependent.
Yeah, sadly the standard model doesn't say that. Okay, but people criticize the Bell experiments as being subject to these questions. So just giving you perspective here. I can't remember the other loopholes. I mean, the detector efficiency loophole and... there's the loophole, which was closed a long time ago by Gregor Weiss, which is that, I mentioned this already, but you want the choice of measurement setting to be done close enough to the actual measurement event that it can't be considered to be in the backward light cone of the other detector. So maybe that's called the causality loophole. That was closed pretty quickly. And then the other thing that's curious about this is, remember, we're assuming that we have independent measurement settings. So how do you do that? I mean, so it's a non-trivial problem because, you can take random numbers that are used from dice rolls and, you say, okay, well, those are random. You can use free choices of a person, which are not randomly distributed very well, not uniformly random. What Gregor did is he put a photon on a beam splitter, which is a 50-50 beam splitter. And so then you have 50-50 chance of the photon going up or down. So it's a quantum randomness, which is supposed to be fundamental. And they use the quantum randomness of that measurement to choose the detector setting for the next measurement. So in order to deny that that's independent, you need some vastly conspiratorial view of the universe. Which then ties into this, what one of the students asked me after class, a question about a very interesting point about how, well, look, I do one experiment, then I do the next experiment. Where is she, actually? She's not here today, is she? Anyways, so you do one experiment, then you do another experiment. Well, the second experiment is in the previous experiment is in its backwards light cone. So you could get a correlation between experiments within a causal picture. Okay, but again, this requires some highly conspiratorial laws of nature to engineer exactly the right kind of results. So it's a very curious point of view. Is there a question, Daniel? Okay, so so that's enough about that. And then just a bit of a historical overview. Yes. Makes sense of, yeah. Yeah, it's something that I think it's not worth the time to really worry about it. It's just good to be aware of it. Okay, so historical overview. So now here's the thing. It's a little bit frustrating, so I'll try and stay calm. But, I mean, EPR in 1935 were the first. This actually wasn't the first. Einstein in like 1928 wrote a letter to Schrodinger. Rob Speckens has a nice paper about this. He wrote a letter to Schrodinger saying, look, there's a conflict between thinking the quantum state is physical and locality. And that was just a private communication, or maybe he gave a conference presentation about it, but it was never published. And then in 1935, with Podolsky and Rosen, Einstein wrote this famous EPR paper. And there he demonstrated a little more of a subtle argument as to why there was a conflict between locality and the view that quantum states are physical, which is not necessary, right? So let me just first say, what's the basic idea? Look, suppose I have some system that emits a photon or an electron, okay, an atom ionizes. Now we describe the ejected electron, say, is going to be emitted, it won't be a perfect spherical wave, but it's some wave that's propagating, the quantum wave function, rather, is propagating over some region of space, right? It could have been emitted this way, it could have been emitted that way. It's in quantum superposition of all of these directions of emission. And so you have this wave front, which is the Schrodinger, oh, there you are. You have this wave front, which is the Schrodinger wave, which is propagating outwards, right? Now, suppose I let it propagate for long enough that this part of the wave front is now outside of the two parts of the wavefront are outside of each other's backward light cones. And now I put a detector, and then suppose I detect the electron over here. Now we know the collapse rule. We know for empirical consistency, the wave function has to collapse if the experiment is done properly. You know, there exists a way to do this measurement so that the wave function obeys the Luder's rule and gets projected onto some subspace of eigenstates that are consistent with it having passed through this space-time region. But instantaneously before that, the wave function was spread out over a vast area of space, which was space-like separated from that event. So the wave function then instantaneously goes from being spread out over this space to being just over here. Now, if you think of quantum states as being information, and that's the same as I put a particle in a box, I have a probability of it being here and here, I discover it here, my information changes, the state of the world does not change, my information changed, and so now my probability assignment collapses to be updated with what I saw. But if you think wave functions are physical, which the entire physics community assumed then and still more or less assumes now, then you have an apparent conflict with locality, right? Because now the physical, what you've assumed to be a physical object has instantaneously changed across space. So Einstein somehow was one of the few people that realized this and pointed it out, and nobody cared, okay? And then so he wrote the EPR paper in 1935 and gave a more subtle argument about this. And I'm not going to go through the details, but he basically said, look, if you assume local realism, and you assume that quantum states give a complete description of the physical properties, So this is, in a sense, a weaker argument because it's assuming the quantum state isn't just physical, but it's the only thing that's physical. And then you assume quantum theory is correct. Then he showed that that leads to a contradiction. And in particular, this was a contradiction that followed only when you prepared entangled states. Now, Niels Bohr had essentially indoctrinated the community to think that, look, we're not even allowed to talk about objective reality. That's just not permitted. There's this actually funny story about Niels Bohr and Heisenberg. So Heisenberg, remember his uncertainty principle, he very much said, okay, you assume the position, the particle has a position and a momentum, and you try and measure it with a photon, and you disturb it, and that's the uncertainty principle. And apparently, Bohr gave him a hard time about that. He said, no, you're not even allowed to talk about particles having properties. So your whole analysis of the uncertainty principle is just unjustified. And Heisenberg was, I think, junior to Bohr, and so more or less acquiesced to his demands. And then apparently, so in his memoirs, Heisenberg writes this story about being out sailing with Niels Bohr and a whole bunch of his high school buddies, like 20 years later after high school. Bohr's high school buddies. So they're out sailing, and then Bohr is like telling his old high school friends, like, oh, we've discovered this new quantum theory. It's incredible what it tells us about the world. It says that there's no objective reality and blah, 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 blah. And then apparently Bohr was a big reader of like turn of the century German philosophy. And so his high school friends were like, well, you didn't need quantum theory for that, Neil. That's exactly what you thought in high school. So I think there's some evidence there that Niels imposed his personal philosophical views through an interpretation of quantum theory and through his stature as a preeminent scientist, rather than came to those views as a result of carefully thinking about quantum theory. It's a very harsh criticism, but I'm sticking by it.
I wanted to ask, like, the argument you gave about the non-locality being very easily explained just with, like, us the update of our personal knowledge of the system. What about if I have two particles state, I separate the particles, and then one of the particles interacts with the third particle, and then I measure the other particle that did not interact, and I obviously get a change of the state of the particle?
We have to be careful there. The word state has two functions. One, it refers to the quantum state, and the other can refer to the physical state. And I'm claiming those are different things. So you have to repeat that.
Okay.
But you know, that's, can I just ask to, we can have this discussion after
yeah.
class, because it seems a bit,
yeah.
it'll take some time for me to think it through. Okay. Okay, so anyway, so basically Einstein was saying a particular, this question two is an interpretational assumption that we don't need to make to do quantum mechanics. One is motivated by special relativity in spirit, and three is, of course, justified empirically. So the point is, people basically thought, okay, well, they just rejected, say, assumption one or whatever they wanted. And Einstein and Podolsky and Rosen said, look, clearly we have to reject two because we want to preserve one and three. So that was the EPR argument. But it turns out, then Bell turned this on its head, right? Now this is where things get, this is where things get complicated. So Bell basically shows that he calls it local causality, or we now call it local causality. It's exactly those assumptions I gave you: parameter independence and outcome independence. And you know, we can make the realism assumption a separate assumption. And then he assumed quantum theory is correct. And he assumed determinism, that the outcomes were determined by the measurement setting and the hidden variables. I shouldn't say the hidden variables, the physical variables. The reason why I don't want to say hidden variables is because remember the variable lambda, which we used in the derivation, doesn't need to be hidden. It could be the wave function itself. Okay, so calling it a hidden variable is misleading, and it leads to the confusion which I'm telling you about. And then he showed this leads to a contradiction. But now this is a problem for Einstein, right? Because Einstein really wanted to preserve local realism. And he wanted to use local realism to show that a particular interpretation was untenable. But it turns out with Bell's result, now we know that local realism is inconsistent with all the interpretations. Even if you want to believe in hidden variables, and you have this very nice story I gave you about, you know, the non-locality of the wavefront propagating through space can be explained just by local locality and the assumption that quantum states are information, knowledge. Now with Bell's theorem, we can't do that anymore. If we look at the Bell setup, we realize that even if you want to assume that quantum states are information and there's underlying physical variables, those physical variables still have to be non-local. So we're kind of stuck with non-locality. Now there are the proponents of many worlds suggest that they don't have a problem with local realism. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not true. I don't want to spend too much time thinking about it. There are a variety of other interpretations like consistent histories which get away from it by just denying, Neil said you can't really talk about anything being real, just the settings on your apparatus. Consistent histories tries to just deny partial reality. So it says, okay, well, these things are real, but these things aren't. And that way non-commuting operators, basically one of them is real at any one time. And it's some story like that. And then you get away from non-locality and things like that by abandoning realism, essentially by abandoning two. Okay. And then let me just finish this quick historical recap, and then I'll take a question. CHSH, which is from 1969, they showed that assumption 4 is unnecessary. I.e., assumptions 1 through 3 lead to a contradiction. And so that's the situation today that we have to make sense of. Okay, was there still a question?
I think you just answered it, but the CHSH, it still requires, say, probabilistic determinism or something. And the world can be completely random, just not even following the rules.
Yeah, but that's inconsistent with what we observe, right? I mean, the very fact that it's not completely random is what allows us to do science. Okay. So, all right, so that's all fun, and it's important historically to understand it. Just be wary that a wide variety of scientists still think that Bell's theorem rules out hidden variables if you want to believe in locality, but the point is really not assuming hidden variables was already inconsistent with non-locality. That's the first thing we knew, and so they're a little bit behind. But now here's where this things get nice. Here's the innovation. So you do this kind of just metaphysical reasoning about nature of reality. Some people can argue it is or it isn't science. But here's what's cool, is that people realize that, hey, wait a minute. This feature of quantum mechanics is something that is a resource. It's something we can use to achieve things that we couldn't achieve without it. So this is the idea that this is the idea of quantum information. Is that, you know, non-locality and entanglement are novel resources. For quantum communication. For communication, I should say. Okay, and so the obvious example of this is quantum key distribution, which allows us to achieve information theoretically secure privacy. distribution. So not privacy based on the assumption that it's hard to factor numbers, but privacy based on the fundamental principles of physics. So this is Eckert, I think, what was it, 1991? Via entanglement. And the modern idea now is they call it device independent QKD. And this point of view is it requires non-locality. It requires violation of a Bell inequality to establish security. And the difference here between Eckert's protocol and this is that when you do want to do something, when you want to exchange information privately, you have to make assumptions. And one of your assumptions in the original Eckert protocol is that I have some device and it performs the way I think it's performing. Now, for people that want to share information privately, and it's very important to them, that's not good enough because you're not building that device yourself. Someone else is building it for you. And so you want to say, well, look, I want to know that I can maintain privacy even though I don't trust this device that someone gave me to use, you know, this box for your detector. And so what's been developed over the past 5 or 10 years is a scheme to be able to establish privacy, private key, where you don't even have to trust the device that you were given. You can just directly perform violation of a Bell inequality, which then proves to you that the device is performing as you expect and guarantees that the key you establish is secure. And this requires violation of a Bell inequality. So just as a point of terminology, I'll say a Bell inequality here. So the point is that, you know, Bell derived an inequality, CHSH derived an inequality, and there are a few others. And they make slightly different assumptions about the experimental setup and or assumptions about, you know, philosophical things like this. And so we just call them all Bell inequalities in honor of Bell. So it's a family of inequalities, and you can use whichever one is most convenient for you in a given setting. Oh, before I do that, let me just also mention that earlier in, what was it? What's BB84? Oh, 1984. In 1984, Charlie Bennett and Gilles Brassard, that's a four. Devised a QKD scheme based on the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So here in their scheme, you don't need entanglement. And it's a very curious thing that quantum mechanics provides two different ways to essentially have private communication, one based on entanglement and one based on the disturbance associated with measurements you can detect an eavesdropper. There's some sense in which these are related, but it's something I haven't understood as deeply as I'd like. So now let me just give you a little fun kind of picture of what we mean by entanglement as a resource. So this is very much a computer scientist's way of thinking about Bell inequalities. So the idea is we have essentially it's a game show, and you have two parties, Alice and Bob. I guess this is Alice, and then you have Bob over here. So basically the idea is they can't communicate. So you've seen this on game shows, right? You put the person in a box and they can't communicate with their friend. Okay? So answer. It will make Bob sad because he can't communicate with Alice there. So now here's the game. The game show is the following. The game is this. There's a referee, and what he does, he's going to ask questions to Alice and Bob. And the questions, we'll just call them 0 and 1. All right? So there's the zero question. It doesn't matter what the questions are, right? There's the zero question and the one question. It can be like, what's your favorite color, and you know, what's your favorite flower, or whatever. And then, sorry. They have to be yes-no questions. I apologize. So it has to be a yes-no question. And okay, I'm not going to give examples of questions. So there's two questions, 0 and 1. And now the rule is that Alice and Bob, how does it work? They want their answers to be the same, either both yes or both no, if they're asked the questions both if. So here we have. Questions. We have Alice gets a question, Bob gets a question. If Alice gets asked question 0 and Bob gets asked question 0, then they want their answer should agree. If Alice is asked 0 and Bob is asked 1, their answers should agree. So they both want to say yes or they both want to say no, it doesn't matter which. If Alice is asked question 1 and Bob is asked 0, they want their answers to agree. But if they're both asked the question 1, their answers should disagree. And if this happens in any given run, they win. And if they fail in a given run, they lose. Now, they do this thousands of times. And then the question is, what's the optimal strategy they can achieve via conventional physics, via classical physics? And that's a question for you guys. I'm going to have a sip of coffee. What's the best they can do, and what's the strategy?
Always, like, they can plan ahead before they come.
They can plan ahead. They can have an arbitrary. They can bring any information, cheat sheets in the room with them.
Agree that they're just always going to both say yes or something, and then they'll agree 3/4 of the time. Mm-hmm. But they'll agree all the time. They'll win 3/4 of the time.
Right. So they could just say, let's just always say yes, okay? And then they win 75% of the time. Now suppose they have to pretend as though their answers are uniformly random. Then they can still do it, right? Because they could share a random bit string. And then if the bit string is a 0, they both answer yes. If the bit string is a 1, for the next question, they both answer no. So it could look like they're answering randomly and still win 75% of the time. And it turns out that's the optimal strategy. So the optimal classical strategy which involves prior planning is 75%. Okay, so now this is where you get the magic of quantum mechanics. Yes?
Sorry. Do they know what question 1 and question 2? Can they tell between the two questions?
Yeah, they're labeled. They're told in advance, here's what the questions are. So question 0 can be, do you like candy? And question 1 can be, do you like tomatoes? And they're told that, but they don't know in any given round which question. So Alice is asked, do you like candy? She doesn't know if Bob was asked, do you like candy or do you like tomatoes? She doesn't know which question he got. So she just has to answer without knowing what question he was asked. But she knows what the two possibilities were.
Are the questions?
Yes.
The
adversary
knows they're doing this. You can just ask 1-1 all the time, and then they're following that stream.
Yes, that's important. That's a good point. So the promise of the game is that the referee asks questions at random. Okay. All right, so here's what's cool. Now, suppose that Alice and Bob are quantum physicists. And so they went to the lab, and they have a little device on their belts. Well, Bob's belt. Alice keeps it. Well, Alice can have a belt, too. And then what happens is, I don't want to gender stereotype here. I did give Alice a dress, though. But so the point is, they have a little device. which has an ordered set of entangled photons. And now what they do is, instead of following a pre-agreed strategy, if Alice is asked 0, she does measurement A0 on the photon. If she's asked 1, she does measurement A1 on the photon. And this is done, you know, maybe our phones in 20 years will have this, okay? And then Bob similarly does the same thing. If he's asked question B0, he does measurement B0, as in our discussion last class. If he's asked question 1, he does measurement B1. What fraction of the time are they going to win? 85%, right? The optimal quantum strategy uses entangled photons, entangled particles. So notice they don't have to communicate to do this. This is all their prior preparation. Allows an 85%, it's actually approximately 85% win percentage. The actual answer, which is an excellent exercise for the students, is cos squared, what is it again? Pi over 8, which is approximately 85. Okay, so this is just showing, just like with QKD, that all of a sudden this phenomenon of entanglement, which really these quantum foundations questions highlighted its significance, now we realize that there is an operational significance to it, not just a metaphysical significance to entanglement. And so this is now my segue to tell you more about entanglement. Was there a question?
Can you say roughly what the measurements are just to get an idea of how it works?
Oh, I showed you last class. It's exactly this.
You mean, okay.
It's this figure, which I showed you last class. So this is measurement A1. This is measurement B0. This is measurement A0, and this is measurement B1. And these are all 45-degree angles. So they have a shared reference frame. And this ties in. I think you had a question about why was there a minus sign in front of the 1-1 term. Well, it's to create this constraint, which makes it classically difficult, right? If they weren't asked to disagree for one of the four pairs, then they could just always agree, right? And it's trivially they win this strategy. So by having one of the four choices be disagree, which is encoded in a minus sign in that formula, that's how you create a constraint that's non-trivial. All right, good. So now I hope you're all super excited to hear everything you possibly can learn about entanglement, which is what I'm going to do next. So our standard notation is going to be we have some joint Hilbert space. And then an arbitrary state can be expressed as a sum over KL, psi KL, AK tensor BL, where psi KL is a scalar, which is equal to the inner product of AK BL against psi KL. Okay, so this is just the standard linear algebra decomposition of the vector with respect to our orthonormal basis, which is a product basis. And a density operator, an arbitrary density operator, would have a decomposition of the form sum over LK, L prime, K prime, rho L L prime K K prime AL AL prime tensor BK BK prime. Okay, these are dummy indices, so it doesn't matter that they move from there to there. Do I swap notation? And then, of course, this coefficient rho L L prime K K prime is exactly this matrix element AL tensor BK rho AL prime tensor BK prime. Okay, so now a definition. A pure state, that's the state of this form, that can be expressed as psi equal to alpha tensor beta for some alpha in HA and beta in HB is called a product state. And is otherwise called an entangled state. Let me move this up a bit for you. Okay, so here we've defined entanglement by saying there does not exist any choice of alpha and beta such that psi has this. Oh, that's sloppy. So an entangled pure state is one for which there does not exist any choice of alpha beta, which allow you to write psi in this way. A density operator rho on HAB is called separable if, we have a question for you guys, if rho AB admits some decomposition . All right, so now I have to not be lazy and write out a bunch of details. So if there exists a decomposition of this form where Pi is a probability distribution. Now, something always, this is just a mathematical question, notational question. If I'm defining separable here, it's sufficient just to say if, right? I don't have to say if and only if. Somehow that's redundant. Is that right? Yeah, you do need, it makes more sense, but often people drop it because it could be, but some states that don't have this form are still called separable, you know what I mean? So, okay, so here I should have if and only if.
But as a convention in definition, like if you're calling it a definition, it's probably safe to leave out.
All right, interesting. I'm learning something.
So, I mean, you you say that you will call those things separable?
Yeah, the wording here is somehow clearer than. Anyways, we'll stick with if and only if, but there's a subtlety there.
You start with the assumption that you never doubly define it.
Yeah, because if somebody says, as you said, like, I have different things that are still separable but not on top of this form, then it's nonsense because you basically said that those are the separable states.
And otherwise, rho is called, oh, here, this is why the only if is not necessary now. And otherwise, rho is entangled. Okay, so what does this mean? This means that, think about what the motivation is for this definition. We're saying that Alice and Bob can have a prior plan, and they can have both, they can communicate classically, and they can flip a coin, generate randomness, and then they can choose to create systems that are correlated. So, you know, Alice says, okay, well, I prepare state row one if we get outcome one. I prepare state row two if we get outcome two, row three if we get outcome three. And Bob similarly prepares state, some state row one. It doesn't have to be the same as Alice's row one, if they get outcome one and two and so on. So just by classically communicating, say over the phone, and having quantum devices, they can generate states of this form. But they can't create entanglement. To create entanglement, you have to be together. Or share entanglement previously. Well, it doesn't really create it, does it? Okay, so now the question is, how do we tell? Given some state, some pure state, or some density operator, how do we decide if that corresponds to an entangled state or not? All right, so notice that what this requires naively is you have to search over a continuously infinite space of possibilities to find the right decomposition. And that's obviously not something you can do in a meaning, in a practical way.
How do you know that you can only create entanglement when you're together?
Yeah, I think that's the gist of it. So let's assume you start with a product state. Well, okay, it's not clear what the right way to set this problem up is. So maybe one way to answer it, I mean, as was just pointed out, if you assume that Alice and Bob both have some states, rho and sigma. So yeah, the question is then their joint state is rho tensor sigma. And now we can say, okay, well, if they're not together, then they can only do local maps. So then the most general action, the most general map, if they're separated, is of the form, you know, lambda Alice cross lambda Bob. And we can act on this input state. And we're just going to get lambda Alice rho tensor lambda Bob sigma. And then this obviously is of the form of a separable state.
What if there were time evolution? Could you start not entangled, and then time evolution on the whole system might not look like that, might not factor like that, and then might entangle them?
To do that, you'd have to have a Hamiltonian with the local interactions.
Yeah, I mean, you know what, I think there's a very kind of simple answer to your question, and it's just evading me at the moment. But yeah, everything would break if what you surmise as possible was possible.
Yeah. It worked. Tons of makes sense, actually.
Yeah, you know, we'll add on the co-interactions because then you could do like a some kind of relativistic transformation which would just completely break. Like,
mm-hmm. Sure.
Would start with, which is general. Yeah, like you don't have simultaneity with a single.
Oh, let me set that aside because I'm not sure the best way to. All right, so here, let's first consider the case of pure states. And what's fun for you guys starting your research careers is that this is going to lead to an open research problem because the criteria for pure state entanglement are well understood, but the criteria for mixed state entanglement is an open problem. Let's go through the basics first. So here we're going to consider the von Neumann entropy. Which is the following for some row. Given a state row, the von Neumann entropy is denoted S of row. And it's equal to minus the trace of rho log rho. Normally, we'll take base 2 for the log. Remember what it means to take the log of an operator. Rho is self-adjoint, so we can write a spectral decomposition. And then you write the spectral decomposition. And then the function of rho is just the function of the eigenvalues in that spectral decomposition. So here that function is a log, so we take the log of the eigenvalues. And then there's a subtlety, because if rho has rank smaller than the Hilbert space, it's rank 1 or rank 2, and the Hilbert space is, say, three-dimensional, then you're going to have zero eigenvalues. So by convention, we assume the log of 0 is 0. Okay, so the von Neumann entropy has the following properties. One, the entropy of a state rho is equal to zero if and only if rho is pure.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that's the way it is in my notes. I couldn't remember why.
Because I mean, like that's kind of true in like any way you want to take. But saying that, if you guys were to say just the log of 0 is where it goes to negative infinity and then
stuff. Right. So I mean, I say something in the notes about the fact that lambda log lambda arises as the limit of 0. Of lambda going to 0 from the right. Two. The entropy is always bound between, is bound by the Hilbert space dimension. Where the upper bound is saturated by the identity state. And here, obviously, I'm assuming that rho is an element of the linear operators on the d-dimensional Hilbert space. For those of you who aren't that familiar with entropy, in general, entropy is a measure of ignorance. So the bigger the entropy, the less you know. And that's consistent here, where we get a zero entropy if we have maximal knowledge, which is we know that the state is some pure state. And we have log d entropy if the state is maximal ignorance, which is the identity state. I know nothing about how the system was prepared. Yeah?
Now, this is telling me that I have a state. Hang on, sorry. Yeah, it's telling me I have a density matrix, which isn't a density matrix of a pure state, but it's not telling me anything about what it's intended to do. Right?
Yes. Well, like, you know nothing about the other system.
Yeah, right. Sure.
If rho is a linear operator on HA cross HB, and rho A is defined as the trace over B of rho, and rho B, as usual, is defined as the trace over A of rho, then the entropy of rho A, okay, I made a mistake here. If there's one more condition, and rho is pure, this is very important, then S rho A is equal to S rho B. Okay, this is not true for mixed states. If the overall state is mixed, then knowing the entropy of the reduced state, you can't know the entropy of the other reduced state. So there's some intuition here about what's going on. The idea is that if the total state is pure, then the only way I get mixing on the subsystem is from entanglement between the two systems. If the overall state is not pure, then I could get mixedness of rho A due to just rho A being intrinsically mixed. So if the total state is pure, the only way I get entropy on my subsystem is due to its entanglement with its partner. And it turns out that means that it has to be symmetric. So my lack of knowledge about system B is exactly equal to my lack of knowledge about system A, because the only source of lack of knowledge is their mutual entanglement. And then here I'll be slightly sloppy with blackboard style, and I'll put 0.4 here, which is called concavity, which is that the entropy of a mixture is always greater than or equal to the mixture of the entropies. So if I have a bunch of states and each one has some entropy, then I mix them together, I'm going to have more entropy, because I won't know, I'll lose information, is basically what's going on there.
Is there a way of, say I have a density operator that I know that I don't know why GNHB is there a way of figuring out figuring out HA and HB, I can square that into one?
Yes, we're going to get to that. Okay, so so the key point now is simply this, that that for pure states, we just saw that you get entropy due strictly to the entanglement. So if I have pure states that are not entangled, if they're a product state, so observe if psi is equal to alpha tensor beta, then rho A is equal to alpha alpha, and rho B is equal to beta beta. And therefore, S of rho A is equal to S of rho B and is equal to 0. So that means that if we know that the subsystem, if we know that the initial state is pure, and we know that the entropy of the reduced state is not 0, then we know the system is tangled. So in other words, in particular, S row A equals zero if and only if row is, if row equal to psi, psi is unentangled. Okay, so that's our criteria for entanglement. But now it turns out I could have chosen a whole bunch of measures. I could have chosen trace row A squared instead of the entropy row log row, trace row log row for my indicator of entanglement. The reason for using the entropy is that not only does it give this kind of yes or no answer to the entanglement question, it also characterizes the degree of entanglement in a meaningful way. S of row A also provides an operational measure of the degree of entanglement. Again, assuming rho equals psi psi is pure. In particular, you know, I'm not going to go into this. You can read my comments in the notes, how it exactly corresponds to this entanglement of distillation, entanglement of formation. I'll just say it in words, you could read the notes, but if I have some pure state and it has some amount of entanglement, S equals 0.2 or whatever, then what that tells me is, given a whole bunch of optimally entangled pure states, like Bell pairs, how many copies of them do I need to create this state? And similarly, given this state, how many copies of pure Bell states can I extract? So that's the sense in which it's operationally significant. But what we definitely wanted to get to is the Schmidt decomposition. Was this covered? Oh, you touched on it? Well, I'll just state it. Given a pure state, psi AB there exists orthonormal bases IA and IB for HA and HB respectively, called Schmidt bases, such that psi can be expressed as a sum over a single index where the lambda I are non-negative and they're square summable to 1.
I'm a little worried that the notation there suggests that IA and IB have the same
thing. Yeah, that always kind of bothered me too, but I think that,
just make it clear.
Well, I don't even know if there's, I mean, I think that, in a sense, they are the same state, aren't they? I mean, they're just some state. It's just some label for a basis.
Yeah, it can be 0, 1, not 0, 0. You can have 0, 1, right? And then the 1, 0.
But I can just relabel 1 to be 0 and 0 to be 1 for B, and then that's not a problem anymore. I mean, I'm free to label the states how I wish. I think that's what's going on here. I agree that if I have some fixed prior labeling of the states, then it would look a bit different, maybe.
The same number of states that A is
good. Yeah, that's the point, is that that's a key point. So you could have a Hilbert space that's bigger, but this Schmidt decomposition will only have support on a lower number, on less states than the full dimension. It's limited by the number of states in HA. Because we're starting with this assumption that we have a pure state, is part of the reason. So let me just say, I'm sorry? I think I like that. Sure.
So now it suggests that they have like intrinsically the same dimension.
Well, this because index like I is only going to go
the,
over.
Because of the index I in the basis.
But they have the same number. It's the same number of them.
You're assuming that. Yeah, I know you're summing only over the same amount, but the like the sets there in the second line are the same.
Yeah, you have to write that I to n and I zero to n.
It doesn't really matter. It's just like the confusion kind of shifts into.
You're trying to imply that you're summing over all AI, and you're saying that AI is a whole basis for HA.
Exactly.
All right, well, let's just set that aside because it's notation. And maybe you guys can sort this out and send me an email. Because I agree, this is something that always kind of bothered me, this notation. The way I gave it to you is the standard notation. And it does always trip me up a bit, like that's a bit weird. And then I just want to make a comment. I think it was last class I wrote down an arbitrary entangled state, and I had a single index, and I essentially wrote the Schmidt decomposition without having told you that. And one of the students came up to me after class and said, shouldn't there be two indices because you have two bases? And what was happening there, if you look back over your notes, is I was using the Schmidt decomposition. So I was actually writing down a general state even though it didn't look like it. So the Schmidt decomposition gives us an easy way to calculate the reduced states if you know the Schmidt decomposition. And the important point is that the number of non-zero lambdas in this expression is a measure of the amount of entanglement. The number of non-zero lambda I in expression 1 is called the Schmidt rank and provides it's discontinuous. There's some reasons to not like this measure. Discontinuous measure of entanglement. Yeah, I said that, didn't I? Well, that's implicit. The lambda i's are non-negative, so that implies real.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, you know what? I don't want to, I just want to wrap this up. So can I have 5 more minutes of your time? Thank you very much for putting it that way. Okay, so criteria for mixed state entanglement. Oh, that's what's going on. Did Neil finish on time today?
No.
No? Oh. Who did? Oh, I did. But did Neil finish on time? No? Oh, okay. Okay, so this is an open problem. Okay, first I want to make sure you understand why what I've told you so far is going to fail for mixed states. Is that obvious? Share with us. Exactly. So consider our state rho AB to be of the form rho A tensor phi phi on B. Okay, this is a separable state. This is separable by our definition. So it's not entangled. But notice that the reduced state, sorry, I shouldn't call this rho A. I should call this, let me call this sigma A. Then the reduced state rho A, which is defined as the trace over B of rho AB, is equal to sigma A. So now if sigma A starts out being mixed, then it'll still be mixed. So then if sigma A has entropy, has S sigma A greater than 0, because maybe it's saying I'm 50% up and I'm 50% down mixture. I have the identity state. Then S of rho A is greater than 0, even though there's no entanglement. Oh, my writing gets really bad at the bottom here. Okay, so clearly this approach isn't going to work, and we need something more clever. Asher Perez is a source of a great deal of more cleverness, and he provided a partial solution to this problem. I have a board here. Sorry? Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. It doesn't work is the point. Whether you know it or not, it's not working. Okay, so, but now there is a clever way to do this. Now remember, this is why I changed the order of the material this year, because now I can explain this properly. Remember we looked at complete positivity of a map. And why did we do that? Okay, so recall complete positivity. We said, look, if you have some map lambda and acting on rho A, it gives some output state, which is positive. That's great. That's a physical requirement. Then we say this says that lambda is positive. But now, if we demand that lambda acting on some joint state rho AB, and what I mean here, remember lambda is acting on, here's important to realize here, lambda is a super operator that takes linear operators on HA to linear operators on HA. Remember, it's only acting on system A. But now if we take lambda tensored with the identity super operator, and we act on some joint state rho AB, and we get some output state rho prime. So then if rho prime AB is positive when the input state is positive, then we say that lambda is completely positive. Because when it acts on part of an entangled state, it still produces a valid state. And we need this to be true because we know we can act on entangled states and do nothing to the other part of it. And so for physical consistency, so that the Born rule produces well-defined probabilities, we must demand this is the case, okay? Okay, so now the very fact that we have to worry about this means that there exists linear superoperators that are positive but not completely positive, okay? So this matters, this distinction matters. Because there exists lambda that are positive but not completely positive. So what does this scream out now? Well, let's identify some maps, these mathematical objects that are positive but not completely positive. Now, if you give me some density operator, you know, I have the matrix, then what I can do is I can apply a map that's positive but not completely positive and look to see if the output state is valid or not. Is it a valid density operator? If it's not a valid density operator, the only way that could have happened is if the input state was entangled. Okay, so this is called the partial... What's it called again? Positive partial transpose, that's what it was. The positive partial transpose test, also called the Perez-Horodecki criterion. So here the idea is that if, so the point is this, lambda t is called the partial transpose which is a transpose map acting on one system tensored with identity. So this is a transpose map on system A. Okay, so now the point is the transpose map is positive but not completely positive. And so if I apply a partial transpose, which means I apply the transpose map to system A, that's a positive map. But when I tensor it with identity, it may not be still be positive. If my input state produces a valid output state, then I learn nothing. If my input state produces a non-valid output state, then I've learned that that input state was entangled.
And you mean it's specifically like A is the input state, A is entangled with the input state.
I think so. Hold on a second. So if, I can write this high up. So the point is that if lambda t acting on rho ab gives rho prime ab, or let, then if rho prime ab is not positive, and of course assuming rho ab is positive, by positive, I mean a valid density operator. It's a little bit shorthand notation, right? Then rho AB is entangled. Okay, so that's the test. And it's a partial test in the sense that it doesn't always tell you the answer. In other words, there exists, it's necessary but not sufficient. The PPT criterion is necessary but not sufficient. Sufficient but not necessary. This is right. What does that mean? So it's necessary but not sufficient. Well, it's exactly what I said.
It's necessary for negation. If it doesn't satisfy the PPT criteria, mm-hmm. you cannot write row AB as like sum over PI or row I.
Yeah, I just thinking about this in front of people always, I always get, you guys can figure this out. It's pretty obvious from what I've said so far. Well, it's whatever I wrote in the notes, so always check the notes. I give an explicit, in the notes there's an explicit example of what the map looks like. PPT is a necessary, or is a necessary condition for separability.
Yeah, necessary separability.
Condition for separability.
And the PPT condition being that row AB prime is positive. Isn't.
Yeah. going too fast now. Anyway, so basically, now here's the neat part. It turns out that it's necessary and sufficient. PPT is necessary and sufficient for the Hilbert spaces C2, tensor C2, C2, tensor C3, and I'm pretty sure also C2, tensor, the infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So if you have small systems or, you know, a photon or the vacuum, the electromagnetic field coupled to a spin half particle, then every state that is entangled will be detected by this test. But in other dimensions, we don't know the answer to this question. And this is very important, because identifying if your state has entanglement is now a critical thing to understand if it's a resource. And so you definitely want some necessary and sufficient condition. So this is an important open problem. All right, I think I'll just leave it at that. Thanks for your time.